Welcome, warrior. You are listening to Bound by Honor, the Klingon Assault Group Book Review Podcast. Your host, Juvon Tai Dung Yi Soon Sin, Jorn Vestai Vampyr, and Jajim Tai Jajim will explore Klingon culture as it appears in Star Trek literature. Perhaps you yourself can hear the cry of your inner warrior. If so, go to www.kag.org and make your presence known. Learn how to join the Klingon Assault Group and begin your journey along the way of the warrior. Now, here are your hosts, Kapla. Welcome, warrior, to Bound by Honor, the Klingon Book Review Podcast. Tonight, we are going to be looking at a Romulan book, actually. This one is the fifth book of the... Am I right there?
Yes, the fifth book.
Okay.
Fifth book of the trilogy.
All right. We're taking a look at the fifth book of a trilogy that makes up an epic story. Sword Hunt and Honor Blade, and finally The Empty Chair. It is the fifth book of the Rionsu series by Diane Duane, where we get a great deal of background on the Romulan Empire. As a matter of fact, it goes all the way back to the days when the Vulcans split into two factions and the Romulans left and started their own society.
I think where you were having problems with the third book thingy was the fact that this particular volume is the third book of a story that's a trilogy of books, and there's a non-trilogy, two sets of books before it. So there's actually five books in the series, but the last three make up one continuous story.
Fair enough. I'm Judge M. I'm joined by our other regular host, Jorn. And who else is with us tonight?
Hello, I'm Kavora.
And Kavora has been with us on all of this journey looking at these Romulan books. And she is especially qualified because she is a member of our Xeno Legions, CAG Xeno Legions. And she cosplays Romulans, among other species. Fill us in. What else have you done?
Besides Romulan, I've done Andorian and Klingon, and let's see, that's about all the aliens. I've done some other Starfleet officers.
Of course, you've done a unique Klingon in that you have done the Miko action figure Klingon.
Yes, that was a lot of fun. Yeah, the Miko action figure actually got a lot of attention.
All right. Well, let's get into this book. Jorn, why don't you give us a summary of how this book goes?
Again, from the back of the book, they call themselves Rihansu, the Declared. To the Federation, they are Romulans. By any name, they are adversaries as formidable as they are inscrutable. Self-exiled from Vulcan in the ages past, they remain an ancient martial philosophy and a code of conduct that has sustained them through the centuries of hardship, warfare, and thwarted ambition. Now their empire is gearing for war once again. Armed with the revolutionary sunseed technology, which can destabilize entire stars, a Romulan vessel is warping towards the heart of the Federation, its target, Earth's sun. But this offensive comes at a perilous time, as a growing number of Romulan worlds are joining a revolution, one led by the renegade commander Ael, now I'm going to butcher this name, Ritarilu of the Warbird Bloodwing, with the aid of James T. Kirk of the Starship Enterprise, and the Hamakai physicist Kutsta Ik. Need more vowels in that. The Federation's foremost authority on sunseed technology. As the threat to Earth looms ever larger, Bloodwing and Enterprise lead an armada toward the Romulan homeworld for a final reckoning that will decide the future of the Rihansu people. And the irony of that description is they don't find out about the threat to Earth until the very end of the story.
So they put it on the back of the book. But yeah, so if you read that first before you read the story, it kind of gives something away.
Only the Romulan Senate knows that it's happening. Nobody else, you know, Earth doesn't know it's coming. Enterprise doesn't know it's coming. Bloodwing doesn't know it's coming until the very end.
Right. They do find out, and then they are able to warn it. But I know you're saying that doesn't really happen until closer to the end of the book.
It doesn't become a threat until the very end of the book. Yeah.
Okay. So let's go around the table and talk about our overall impressions. Kavura, you go first.
I enjoyed the book, and I thought it was a good ending to the whole series. This one was, to me, it was more action because it's already established all the characters, and so you just get this everything going and with the plots, and it's kind of, it's all been established. Like, we know all the Romulan intrigue, so it's more of that and more of the battle scenes. So, I mean, it was a good ending just with just more action than anything else.
Okay, and Jorn?
Now, yeah, I agree that it had more action and went a little bit deeper, and there was less sitting around thinking about things forever and ever and ever. But I, even though this is a very thick book, believe that the story needed a long ending. We see the space battle scenes going off, going in detail. We see what happens. Then they begin. Kirk and Bloodwings and the revolutionaries, the Romulan revolutionaries, planned invasion of the homeworlds, and it's kind of, nothing happens. It fizzles out. Everybody just gives up.
I really enjoyed this book out of all of them. It was the best book in the series because it did keep moving forward. And it held my interest all the way through. I enjoyed the characters. I thought they were written true to, at least the Enterprise characters were written true to what they should have been. And I could hear the voices as I read. So, yeah, I enjoyed this book.
See, I have to agree with you on that and what Kavura said. And I think that's what made the ending for me so disappointing, in that Diane Duane had done so well up to the actual land invasion that I really wanted to see that plotted out a lot better.
I think that, it seems like by the time we got to the end of the book, you know, like it was already a thick book before that. And maybe she felt like, you know, that if she wrote the book in order, then maybe she felt like when she got to the end, it would have been too long. So she cut the last scene short. But I do agree, there was the big buildup at the end, and then you didn't really get to see a large description of the battle like we did with the two previous battle scenes in this book.
It's like she knows how to write space battles, but the land battle threw her for a loop on how you tell that type of a story.
Did the land battle seem to either one of you that to be almost like it was kind of a rush to the end?
I thought that's what I was saying.
Yes, it was. It was kind of, there wasn't as much description there. We didn't get to see as much of what happened. They showed a few things, but yeah, it wasn't as detailed. As far as the battle part, I think that they took it from the view of more of the individual characters.
It seemed to me like she wanted to spend more time on the aftermath than the actual battle, installing, who did she install?
AL.
Okay, that's what I thought. It seemed like she wanted to spend more time on installing AL as the new leader and getting the sword back and getting things back in order than she did really on that land battle.
And I think that's the problem with a story arc that goes so long as these five volumes do. It needs an epilogue of that weight.
And which so all the stuff at the end, installing the new Empress, I mean, I liked reading all of those scenes. I thought that was good. I mean, and that did go on. It went on a little longer than we thought maybe it should, but I still think it was good to see all that and to see how Aeol was put there and that she didn't want it, but she accepted it gracefully. And Spock and going and giving her his sword. All of that was good.
I agree. So are there any other characters we would like to dig a little deeper into? There's a bunch of characters in this book.
But I think they're all characters that are holdovers from the other books that we've talked about in the other podcasts. Was there anybody new introduced?
No, there wasn't, was there?
Because this was just a long story of a long struggle that involved these characters from the get-go. So they're already there for us.
The other books used more of the minor characters like Narat, the Horda, and, Kastilk, the Hamalki. Those characters were not used as much in this book because this one just wanted to get to the meat, to the nitty-gritty, so it focused more on the main characters.
Well, it actually had a long way to go to get to the ending that she wanted to get to.
Well, let's talk about briefly the triumvirate of praetors that secretly dominate the government. The ones that are, I think, just looking for some kind of a war, trying to get something started between whomever.
They have their own selfish goals, and you kind of read it like they're doomed to fail. I mean, I guess that's what they want the reader to think, because it's because you know that they're just, well, of course we know, because they're going against the Federation, and in the Star Trek book the Federation has to win, but it does seem like they're so selfish and self-absorbed that they had to fail.
It seemed like they started fighting amongst themselves rather than pursuing what their original goal had been, and that was to influence the government the way they wanted to see things go. But they just kind of fell apart.
Well, the Romulan they tried to assassinate in the last book, wasn't he part of that triumvirate, and then they replaced him with someone?
I thought he was an important member of the Senate, right? Gurren, that one?
I think so.
Okay, yeah, he was someone that was important, and, you know, he came from a high family, and he was a senator. He had been part of the triumvirate.
Well, he was a praetor, and I was kind of thinking that was the triumvirate was the three praetors.
See, now, I thought Gurren was a good guy.
He was when we see him, but he might have been, you know, something else in his past, and something made him change, like seeing the government change and seeing how the top three had become so self-centered and taking the empire in the wrong direction, just like A.L. was saying.
Well, it seemed like they were concentrating. What really got things started was the Romulans were concentrating mostly on what was going on Romulus itself. And the outer colonies were getting forgotten or exploited. The people were getting tired of it. And really what got this whole thing started was they wanted their say in the government too.
And they were being discriminated against because they were the flight people that brought the Vulcans to Romulus to become the Romulan.
Yeah.
That is a large part of the story. The Romulan colonies were becoming unsettled, and they felt like they were being ignored. They were only there just to do the labor and to be taxed.
Yeah,
so they started rebelling.
They were getting attacked, actually, weren't they?
There were several scenes where they were removed from a village or discriminated against in one way, one shape or another.
They were being coerced in order to make them do more work, wasn't it? The Romulan soldiers came and took over their planets after a while, after the Romulans wanted more production from them.
So how do the Klingons fit into this whole picture? The Klingons are mentioned, and in this book, I kind of felt like they were going to really take a major role, and then they kind of backed off on that, and we continued with what we got. And were the Klingons just kind of forgotten?
For this, it does kind of look like the writer didn't know how to handle Klingons, because they were, I mean, because I guess she wants this to be a Romulan book anyway. But the Klingons showed up in that first battle, and then there was that one ship that survived and went back home and was sort of, you know, groveling, saying, "Oh, they're too powerful. We can't beat them." And it just seemed like, well, a Klingon, what if he would have stayed and.
Early on in the series of books, they were trying to set up a scenario, particularly Romulans were trying to do this, where they were getting the two other main factions in the galaxy, in the quadrant, to fight each other. The Klingons may have looked to see that the Romulans were having a problem with reactionary people, and that Kirk was also involved, and said, maybe we should keep our hands off until the dust settles and see who's the weaker of the parties for us to attack.
There was, yeah, that was mentioned throughout the series about the three powers, the Klingons, Romulans, and Federation, and one party thinking the other two could go to war at each other, and the other one would sit back and watch. But then the Federation got involved with the Romulans because they saw this the sun sea thread, and saw a lot more internal things going on with the Romulans, I think. That's why Kirk and the Enterprise were there in Romulan space.
And I think that's an interesting thing to try and pin down. The Klingons would love to see the Romulans and the Federation go at each other. The Romulans would love to see the Klingons and the Federation go at each other. But would the Federation, if it was Klingons and Romulans, try to keep the peace?
It's interesting, like, what would the Federation do, yeah, if the Klingons and Romulans went to war?
Well, they would, I'm sure they would try to mediate between the two. They would have to have somebody very special to do that, and it sure wouldn't be easy.
And you had to think that at one point, the Romulans and the Klingons did go to war, and the Federation did step in to help out, because Worf was on Khitomer, I believe. They got attacked, and here it is, the Federation that swoops in and tries to help any survivors, a.k.a. Worf gets picked up and taken back to Earth.
Yeah. Well, in the case of this book, it just seems like the Klingons are just fine with hanging back, hoping that the Federation and the Romulans get into a big furball with each other, and then they would just step in and pick up the pieces.
It seemed like they were doing that, but since nothing happened between the Federation and the Romulans in the end, then the Klingons didn't get involved.
Yeah. I found something interesting in this book that I kind of enjoyed and was a little puzzled by. Captain Kirk was chosen to be the leader of this entire thing, and he took the responsibility on, but other than the Romulans that were rebelling and with him, there weren't a whole lot of people that were behind Kirk for doing this.
Getting Kirk in charge, yeah, I wonder if that was more of a plot device than anything. But it seems like the Romulans would get behind A.E.L. more and make her the leader. They did say that they see her as kind of their savior as well as Kirk.
But Kirk is that mysterious boogeyman that wins every battle that he's involved in and is the bane of any strategy the Romulans or the Klingons come up with. So to have him as the figurehead kind of gives faith to the people that are following.
Yeah, but didn't Kirk make a few mistakes here along the way and have a few pretty close shaves as the story went on?
Well, he's not a tin-plated god.
A tin-plated, overbearing dictator with delusions of godhood?
Yeah, there you go. You got the exact line now.
It's one I'll never forget. So anyway, we have a couple of different battles here. We have the Battle of Algo, which is one big battle that the Romulans almost would have won had not the one member of the Triumvirate diverted ships away.
And that was interesting too, because it seems like it was a battle that we don't really know if the Federation would have won if those other ships hadn't been there. But what was interesting was the new technology. That was when they introduced, wasn't it, when they had the Romulan ships that could, with the cloaking device, it couldn't be detected at all. Before, they said they could detect a little bit of ion trail or something, and now they couldn't detect anything from these ships.
Yeah, a new cloaking device. And didn't the cloaking technology originally come from Klingons?
No, in the...
Or do I have it backwards
series,
in...
the Romulans developed the cloaking technology, and fan theory says that they traded it to the Klingons for old Klingon battleships that the Romulans weren't making enough of.
Oh, okay. That's it. Well, you know why the Romulans started using Klingon battleships?
You mean in actuality? Somebody stepped on the original model.
Yeah. The original Romulan ship model got crushed before it could get filmed, so they went back into some stock film with a D7 cruiser and said the Romulans are using Klingon design now.
That was a pretty clever way to explain it. Yeah, just one word, just get on with the story.
Yeah. Well, at least by golly, they gave an explanation. We've encountered a few stories for this podcast where we need more explanation. And as John had pointed out several times, just one simple sentence would have solved a whole lot of guesswork.
Especially with things like why the Klingons changed in so many Star Trek shows.
We don't talk about that.
Right. And that's a good explanation too.
Yeah, we don't talk about that to outsiders.
God. For the longest time, that was the most beautiful explanation for the ridges, non-ridges issue.
You mean just not talking about it?
No, Worf coming out and flat out saying that.
Oh, okay. Well, Enterprise kind of made a mess out of that, didn't it?
Despite the fact that fourth season was probably the absolute best season of Enterprise.
I wanted to talk about the technology, because the colonies, like on that first battle on Ardalier, that planet, there was just a colony planet that we thought was supposed to be poor on resources. It turned out they weren't. They had the ability to fire on a ship from the surface of the planet, and then they had some kind of super dome shield. Wasn't that just a big surprise? I mean, it was just something amazing in the story.
That they had that sort of technology. That it did kind of come out of left field, didn't it?
Yeah, there's a pretty good reason why you put your planetary defenses in orbit rather than trying to fire from the planet.
And what is that? You mean because usually you can't fire from the planet?
It's one hellacious gravity well.
Another thing they had was the super ships in this. Those colony ships. There was the Taivara and the Kaveth. I mean, that was pretty interesting, too. So they had ships that were bigger than the Romulan fleet ships and more powerful.
Well, that kind of made sense to me because they were trying to get everybody together and move out of Romulan space. To do that, you're going to need one heck of a generation ship, one huge ship to put all your people into.
Now, the people manning those ships, those very large ships, they had chosen to stay on board the ships, had they not?
But they also, for the purpose of this story, they were also very good battleships.
Oh, they were. They were very scary, as a matter of fact, as I recall reading about them.
If you're going to have a colony ship in a galaxy as violent as the Star Trek universe, you're going to need some pretty impressive defenses because you want to protect that basket that has all your eggs in it.
Exactly.
The technology that I thought was interesting and kind of got dropped after these books was the technology that the rebels used to go in and take over the other Romulan ships to build their own fleet.
Yeah, that was something else that was very exciting that they could do that, and surprising. Like, where did that come from?
I think there are a lot of those in this series of where did that come from type tech. But some of it stuck around, and some of it, like these, were introduced in the end. The sunseed technology, which was pretty impressive, stuck through the entire series.
And that was something I was surprised they kept using because, in the first book, My Enemy, My Ally, that sunseed technology was considered a threat. And I was surprised that the Federation, Kirk decided to take it on and try to use it to his advantage. I never would have thought he would do that.
Remember, he was trying to find a way to insulate suns from that technology. And the only way you can test to see if your theories actually work is to try and trigger an event and shut it down.
And that was a lot of these stories was experimenting with that. seeing what they could do with it.
And if you get a gun in Act One, somebody's got to get shot with it before the play's over.
Chekhov's gun. Not Pavel Chekhov's gun, but...
The Russian Chekhov.
Yeah. Duh. All right, so we had another little thread that kind of ran through the story a little bit. The Nova bomb.
Wasn't that the Sunseed Tech?
No, this was a bomb that was sent directly to Earth's sun and was supposed to blow it up and take the Federation completely out of the picture. And you get little hints of this all the way through there, all the way through the book until the very end. And then Enterprise and Bloodwing's crews get together and manage to cause a reaction in the Eisen system star, and it kind of synchronizes and diffuses the reaction because nobody could stop this thing from getting through.
Mainly because they didn't find out about it till the end of the book, which is what I was talking about in the summary earlier on. And they were so far away from Earth, and the bomb was so close to Earth that even if they sent a message to Earth, it wouldn't get there in time.
Yeah. I think Starfleet heard about it and was trying to intercept, but they just could not get to it because it was moving too fast. I do recall though, earlier in the book, didn't the three evil praetors, weren't they talking about this?
Yeah, I believe so, but Kirk can't send a message to Earth until he finds out about it. And I think, I could be wrong on this, didn't they have some sort of cloaking device on the thing that was sending the bomb to Earth's sun?
Yes, I believe they did say that. The unmanned ship that had the bomb, that was cloaked.
So that makes it even tougher.
Yeah, but did not R.A., did she not find out about this from one of those three and then try to get word, or did get word through so that they could try to find it and stop this thing?
Yes, I think that was when she got that mysterious call and it told her something. I mean, yeah, there's a lot of this like mystery stuff. You hear somebody hear something, but you don't know what they heard or who they heard it from at the time that you're reading it. But yeah, that she found out about it and she was able to send word to, how did she do it? She sent it to Kirk on the Enterprise. She was able to get a warning out to them.
Yeah.
See, and that's why I talk about in the concepts, it seems like the Romulan Empire has more leaks than our current White House.
Okay. Another thread that was throughout this book, mysterious thread, was Kirk had these secret orders that were being referred to over and over and over again that were given to him directly by the Federation president. And he apparently was supposed to retrieve a vital piece of technology from the Romulans. So why don't we discuss that a little bit? Any thoughts?
Was it ever spelled out what exactly the tech was he was supposed to get? Or was it any nebulous super secret technology that he could steal from the Romulans?
I was wondering that too. Now, I think the book did say, it said that AL did give it to him at the end, but it still didn't say what it was.
Any speculation as to what it might be?
Again, I thought it was anything he could get his hands on.
So nothing specific, you think? Just
what can you give me? I want something. Give me something.
To bring back. Yeah, because how much does the Federation know? I mean, what would they be able to tell him specifically to get? I mean, I don't know how much they knew about the Romulans to actually tell him exactly what to get. So it might have been just get anything you can.
As far as we know, their best spy was the maid senator Ahura. Oh, not Ahura. Arhe.
Yeah, R.A.
Romulan names are hard to pronounce.
Yes, R.A. That's the way I say it. She was probably the foremost spy. And now that she's a senator, I mean, now that she moved up, she has even more power.
Even more connections.
Yeah, and she discovered another Federation operative on Romulus with her.
And yeah, he was someone who discovered who she was just because she sang in her sleep.
Yeah, I always wondered about how effective it was for the Federation to have spies on Romulus disguised as Romulans when any scratch would give them away.
Yeah, I thought about that before myself. You know, how do you change a person's physiology to match something that they're not? And that, but that just never seemed to be something that was going to happen.
I've read in other Star Trek novels that they have tried something like putting on, they can put something on their arm so if they get pricked, they actually bleed green instead of red. But yeah, but that still seems like it's a very iffy system. It could still fail at some point.
Especially if it's a deep cut.
Yeah. Well, and then, you know, there's illnesses that require surgery. So, you know, if a person had appendicitis, for instance, you know, the physiology for humans and Romulans are probably not going to match up well enough, and this person could die from a very simple procedure.
Well, if they're a really good spy, they're going to die before the procedure.
Ah.
Good old cyanide pill.
I always thought a person in disguise would, like, she would still need, like, at least one person who knows who she is that could help her, which she did have that at the beginning. I mean, it was talked about in
Romulan Way. Before she was sold off to the household that she became the head servant of. Yeah, they talked about her contact.
Let's talk a little bit about AL and her forming of the government and then deciding that it was time to back off and cut off relations with the Federation. That seemed a little odd to me.
That was actually thrown in because this was written after The Next Generation. And in the, you know, in the Next Generation timeline, they said the Romulans had gone silent for several years and then came back at the end of the first season. So it was just a way to explain why there were, you know, on Star Trek, they actually said they hadn't heard from the Romulans in a while.
Yeah, see, now I recall that very well. And the Romulans kind of kept quiet and to themselves and did their own thing. However, I think we've discussed before that these books seem to be written in an alternate timeline kind of thing. And they don't, in which case they wouldn't need to agree with canon.
That is true because they developed the Romulans in a different way. But I still think they still want to have to stick canon as much as they could. I mean, as far as the things they haven't already strayed from, like, oh, let's just try to keep this part in sync with the rest of the story.
Yeah.
There's also the fact that if AL is taking over and going to try and rebuild the honor and dignity and rebuild her society, she may want to cut off ties with surrounding star communities so that the Romulans, the Rihansu, can focus on making themselves great again.
It does seem like trying to rebuild her empire from within, which sounds like a good idea. I mean, like, contact with the outside until we build up what we have here and get a stable government again. The problem might be, like, how would they really be able to do that? They may not, in reality, we say in the book reality, be able to really avoid the Klingons coming in if they wanted to.
No, but if the idea is that to project dignity, to get other people to respect you, you have to respect yourself, then she needs to get her culture to start respecting itself again.
I can see that as definitely what she had in mind that she wanted to do.
Now, see, I would have thought that they would have wanted some help from the Federation, that they maybe even needed it because we've got, we have infighting going on. There's probably going to be more problems with those that were loyal to the government before, and they need to produce food, and planets have been devastated and need to be revitalized so that they can produce for themselves, at least have a Federation presence for a little while to help them get back on their feet rather than try to do it all by themselves.
Again, I think it gets back to the dignity thing. And the Romulans really do want to pull themselves up by their own bootstraps.
It's an interesting thought because we know the Federation would help. I mean, if they were asked, because anybody that asks the Federation for help, they always help them. So this must be a case where, I mean, in one issue maybe, because we know some of the Romulans still don't trust the Federation, so they would have had that to contend with. And Aeol must have been thinking, well, Kirk has done so much, and she does want to rebuild herself, and she thinks she has the resources to do that. She thinks she has enough of the people on her side that it can get done without any help.
Yeah, and thinking a little bit deeper on this, of course, Kirk and Aeol were suspected by many to be romantically involved with each other. We, of course, know that did not happen. That was not the case. They both of them behaved very professionally as equals. Maybe knowing that this was part of it, maybe Aeol also did not want it to seem like she was a figurehead with Kirk telling her what to do.
Right back to the dignity thing.
In any case, at the very end of the book, Kirk returns to Earth and he takes a banner from an olive tree that he had hung there before, with Aeol's name on it, and just lets it drift off into the sea. And I thought that was kind of symbolic of the way the relationship was supposed to go.
That was a throwback to the "My Enemy, My Ally." At the very end, he had hung that banner because Aeol was said to no longer have a name because she had been banished. And now she's back. She does have a name, so he could let the banner go away. But that is a different thought that it has to do more with their relationship now. And it's very symbolic of that, too.
Yeah, he just let her go, let her name go off on its own as she asked him to let the Romulan people go off and heal themselves.
It was a fitting ending to this series because it ties back to the first book, just like the whole series had a lot to do with Aeol, except really for the Romulan way, it was all about Aeol and her struggle.
Yes, and the sword is restored, and the government is restored, and the three bad guys are caught, and they're going to get their comeuppance. And how about closing thoughts on this book, or the whole series for that matter?
Well, as I've been, because you've heard me say all through the series, I enjoyed all of these books, actually. And I think it's a good examination of the Romulans. And with the female writer, I mean, I assume that's the reason that these books had such strong female characters in Aeol and Arai. And we know that Romulan society usually treats men and women as equals. So they had these strong female characters. And it was just a really good story all the way through, examining what could happen with the Romulans and how you can basically be friends with the enemy, or who really is your enemy. And he was really your friend, because Aeol was betrayed by her friends and her son as well. The whole story carries through as very much a Star Trek story. And
it's interesting that the first book of the five and this book of the five were the most action-packed books of the entire series. The second book in the series is very good as a history book, but kind of reads like a history book because every other chapter literally was, and there was a lot of deep philosophical thoughts going on in books three and books four that led us up to the conflicts and the action that takes place again in book five.
I would have to agree. I don't think a person can approach this, even though the books seem like they could be standalone. They aren't. They are definitely connected with one another. And if you read the first one and not read the last one, then you don't get a complete picture. This is one huge story. It took a long time to write, a long period of time to get it all released and out. But I think it was worth it.
The first book came out in the 80s, didn't it?
Was it 89, I think?
And this book was published in 2006, so that's almost 20 years to produce 5 volumes.
It was mostly the last one, right? It was like 5 or 6 years in between the 4th and 5th ones. And I read different things, the reason because Diane Duane was sick for a while, and also because they weren't sure if they wanted to finish the story with the Romulans, because on the Next Generation they had gone in a different direction. But then Pocket Books got a different editor who did want to finish the story, so he let her finish the story.
Oh, that's good, because this 5th book kind of makes up for the slug that you got to get through on books 3 and 4. It's a better payoff.
Yeah.
And I did want to mention, I also read that, Arai, the one that was the spy, she's mentioned in another book later on. There's the series of Romulan books that Josepha Sherman and Susan Schwartz wrote. And they had somewhere, not in the story, but in the notes of one of the books, they said that Arai retired as a Commodore or something. So that's just interesting. They'd like to just keep the character.
Huh, that is interesting. That might be something to look at in the future.
Was this another book by Diane Duane or someone else?
No, it's by Josepha Sherman and Susan Schwartz. They also wrote a series of Romulan books that also have the history of Romulus, and it's a little different, but they focus more on they talk about the development of the Remans, which we didn't read in this book.
So, looks like we've come to the end of this one. Any other thoughts on this before we close out?
It's a big book, and as far as I can tell, we dissected it fairly well.
And as Jorn recommended before, if you want to read the series, you should probably have all of the books before you start reading them.
That I would agree with.
And don't expect to read them all the same way, because they're each written slightly differently, and you should go into each one by itself rather than trying to think it's just the same writing style all the way through.
All right. Well, let's talk for just a moment. Kavura, why don't you tell us some of the things that you are into? You've got some other podcasts you're involved with and things like that. And I'll tell you what, you've got a real good thing going down there.
Thank you very much. My husband, Nayar, and I have 2 podcasts. We do Starpod Log, which is about classic sci-fi and fantasy. And we have Starpod Trek, which is about all things Star Trek. And so we have our Facebook group, Starpod Log and Starpod Trek, and we're also on Twitter and Instagram. And you can find the podcast on Blogger and iTunes and Spotify and anywhere you listen to podcasts.
And it is a fun show to listen to. I mean, the memories that you bring back, things like that, it's just a lot of fun. You go for an hour and the time goes by very quickly because there's so much there, and it's a lot of fun.
Thank you. Enjoy doing it.
For Bound by Honor, join us next time. I'm Ja Jim.
And I'm Jorn.
I'm Kavura.
And tune in again next time. Tune in again next time for Bound by Honor. Kapla.
Kapla.
You have been listening to Bound by Honor, the Klingon Assault Group Book Review Podcast. Bound by Honor is brought to you by the Klingon Assault Group and is produced by Admiral Kirk Zantai Loon Keej. If you hear the call of the warrior, visit our homepage at www.kag.org to learn more about what it means to be Klingon. Perhaps you have what it takes to be one of us. Listener feedback is always welcome at podcast@kag.org. Kapla! Romulus est
ist Frieden.